Okay. Can everybody hear me okay? If I stand behind here, you'll never see me. So as Chris said, I'm going to talk to you about chemical and biological, both the response and the decontamination, specifically aimed at civilian facilities, which is really quite different than what you would expect if the military were responding to an incident. So I just want to start off explaining the problem a little bit to you. Most of you are probably familiar with, or if you're not, in 1979, that was when the first potential biological incident happened, and that was in Russia in Sverdlovsk. And, you know, here's Moscow is around here, and here's Sverdlovsk. And this incident caused between 120 and 400 persons to get sick, and at least 75 people died. Initially, it was blamed on contaminated meat, and you can see this is the area that the plume carried the biological warfare agent, which was Bacillus anthracis. And initially, it was blamed on contaminated meat, and later this was linked through intelligence and even through discussions with the Russians to a bioweapons facility that had been working in research and development. This incident was very interesting because the people that got sick were not the young children, were not the elderly people that you would expect, but they were actually the healthy white males between the ages of about, you know, 45 and 55. And this was the first indication that we really don't understand infectious dose as well as we think we do, and that we need to understand, you know, the inhalation hazards associated with this better and how it might affect public policy. So that's 1978. Now
I think a mass was involved, Dana.
Excuse me?
I think a mass of anthrax material was in the flu.
There's a lot of different calculations, and they range a lot. But basically, the infectious dose that we believed would have caused an individual to die would have ranged back then, and actually it was the current standard until just recently when we had the issues in the U.S., would be an inhalation factor of between 6,000 and 10,000 spores. So how much was actually released, I don't know. But there are several references, and Methelson out of Harvard has one calculation. There's some Stanford calculations which are different also. And the Russians have never been forthcoming on the amounts. So 1992, here we are in Tokyo. Amsterdam Rinkio again tried it. They tried another anthrax attack. They tried it in the subway station area. And what happened? Well, they were actually very successful at releasing a plume of anthrax. However, it was anthracis stern, which is not the virulent form of anthrax. So even though people did inhale this amount, it was not an infectious form of anthrax. We think that perhaps they just didn't know what they bought, what they purchased. There's a lot of speculation on what happened, but it's a good thing that it turned out that way. So now let's go ahead. 1995. Here again, Amsterdam Rinkio, again in Tokyo, in the Tokyo subway. Sarin nerve gas was released, and many of you might be familiar with this because, you know, it just happened as little as 10 years ago. 12 people were killed, 6,000 people were injured. There's a lot of reports on how they actually did the decontamination and the cleanup, but most of those reports are basically speculation. If you went to do a literature search, you could not find anything except a reference to bleach powder that was used, and this is the decon team going down into the subway to clean up afterwards. You can find no information whatsoever about the levels of cleanup that were required or how they actually cleaned the subway up to say that it was available for public use again. There isn't anything on the internet that we could find or checking through various resources. And if any of you, and I give it to you as a challenge, can find that, please let me know because I've been looking for it for quite a while and it would be nice to know, and you'll see how it fits in with some of the things that I'm going to talk to you about in a little while. So I just would like to show you a brief clip of the actual incident of how it happened in 1995, in case some of you aren't familiar with that. Oh, thank you. With my help. There's the decon people. So this is real. This is something that we really do need to be prepared for. Sarin is probably the most likely of the nerve agents to be used in an actual attack.
The How long did it take them to about figure out what was going on?
Excuse me?
How long did it take them to figure out what was going on in the first place?
It's relatively quick. Any hazmat crew could recognize the signs of a chemical warfare agent. So I would say, I don't know how long it took the hazmat team to get there, but I would say, you know, within a couple of minutes of arrival on the scene, they would have identified that it was a nerve agent.
Okay.
It's the most all hazmat teams are trained in that, and they were back in 1995. So what I was saying on the sarin gas, that is probably the most likely gas that would be used, but it is also probably one of the most easiest to decon because it hydrolyzes. That means that if you add water to it, dilution is your solution to getting rid of it because it hydrolyzes into non-toxic components, which is not true for something like VX because their hydrolysis can help you to some degree, but you're also still left with toxic compounds. So I bring that up because if you're in an airport or you're in a facility where something like sarin nerve gas is released, one of the best lines of defenses is if the sprinkler system were to come on. That would, you know, hydrolyze the remaining CW agent that was available. And sure, you'd have some cleanup afterwards, but it would stop it from affecting additional people. So I'm going to go ahead to 2001. If we didn't think that we could have an incident like that in this country, we certainly found out otherwise. Here in Florida, New York City, Washington, D.C., the newspaper said that, you know, New York Times, two workers die, two are ill at the Capitol's Postal Center, inhaled anthrax indicated. Anthrax scare closes the Supreme Court. Anthrax cleanup fraught with messy uncertainties. So my point in bringing this up is that effective response and decontamination for civilian chem bio incidents is a real need. We do really need to be prepared. It's not speculation anymore. So this just shows you the letters that were sent to the different buildings. This is the letter that went to Senator Daschle's office. This is the letter to Tom Brokaw in NBC in New York and to Senator Leahy's office. All of the projects took years to clean up, just years. It was a major undertaking, as I'll show you, some of the infrastructure that was involved. The U.S. Post Office, both D.C. and New Jersey, the estimated cost of remediation was more than $200 million just to clean up those facilities. And to what standard? I'll talk about that in a little while. The Department of State Mail Facility, the building had to be completely gutted. There was 400,000 pounds of material that was hazardous waste that needed to be removed of. The amount of hazardous waste that's generated is really a key factor. You're not allowed to bury it in certain landfills. You don't want to incinerate it because that represents a health hazard. And that's something that the EPA is actively dealing with right now in case there's another incident. The AMI building in Florida, it just recently opened again last year as a test facility. And so what we learned from these attacks as well is that there's a lot of question on the infectious dose levels. As you probably saw in the newspaper, there were individuals that we suspected who were only exposed to less than 100 spores, and they were infected. Now, why? Well, we'll talk about that a little later. So, that's the next one. Okay. Any kind of decontamination or restoration issue, and how you go about doing it is site specific. And it's very important to look at this as a function of an outdoor facility, which would be like a stadium or a mall, like Chris talked about, the DC Mall. There you have a lot of environmental variables that you have to consider, but natural dilution, natural remediation, natural attenuation, just leaving it alone in many cases, that's enough to allow for restoration or remediation. Then you have the semi-enclosed environment, which is like an airport, a really large area, or a subway like the Metro or like the BART here in San Francisco. That's almost a combination of enclosed and outdoor, and you have to consider both those types of characteristics. And then there's the Hart Building, and this is actually the Hart Building, where you have an enclosed office building or a hotel. In those kinds of scenarios, public perception issues are really key. However, on the good side, those types of enclosed facilities are more amenable to ventilation interventions. Outside is very, very difficult to clean up. And the wide area biological problem, if there were a real wide area attack today, at this moment, we're not really that effectively prepared to deal with that. DHS is working really hard to come up with a plan. We do have plans now for the airports and the subways, and we've been through the cleanups for enclosed facilities. But the wide area problem represents a whole host of different issues. So how do we go about looking at this? Well, chem and bio response decisions really need to be risk-based. And we now, and by we I mean DHS and the whole interagency community, which includes DOD and EPA and the cities and the state OES offices, are now looking at this as a function of the three R's. We call it response, restoration, and recovery or reoccupancy. And so there's six key phases in case an incident happens. The first phase is the notification phase. You know, that's when an operation sensor actually suspects that there's been a release. Now, you probably read in the newspaper 2 weeks ago, the BioWatch sensors in New York City gave a suspect signal that there was tularemia that had been released on the Washington Mall. And so we actively reanalyzed and resampled. Los Alamos was out there taking additional environmental samples, and the analytical lab network that's been set up across country to deal with this looked at whether it was naturally occurring tularemia or not. And it appears that it was a natural event. It's questionable whether anything was viable. That means whether it was actually alive and could be cultured. So CDC decided not to call that a live release. And there was no additional information that suspected any kinds of terrorist activities. Now, in Texas, there was naturally occurring tularemia at another event. And so this becomes difficult because you have to decide whether it's due to natural background in many cases or due to a weaponized event. After there is a confirmed positive, or even before that, if people were getting sick, if there was a chem incident, or if there were a suspect powder released at San Francisco Airport, the first responders are going to be right there, and hazmat and emergency actions are going to take place anytime there's something that's suspected. At the same time, there's going to be identification and prioritization of contaminated areas such that an airport or a BART can decide whether they really need to close down or whether they can continue operations. At the end of the first response phase, a key question is asked, and that's whether or not this has been a real release. If it's a real release, and if the organism is viable, then you go into a restoration phase, which includes a restoration of, I guess, phase, which includes both characterization, really understanding the extent of the contamination and the extent of the problem, whether there's any impact to human health and the environment. Now, in the case of chem, you can see people are affected. But in the case of bio, many of these biological warfare agents, they're very difficult to keep alive. And so they may not represent an actual environmental hazard unless they're infectious and can spread from person to person. And that's where CDC and public health department are critical in making that assessment. And that all happens in this characterization phase. If it's decided that there really is a big cleanup problem, as the case with the anthrax letters and the cleanup of the buildings, you go into a remediation and decontamination phase where you try to optimize your strategy and your approach. And then, after you've done the decon, comes the key question, have you cleaned this up enough to public standards when no public standards really exist? And that is very difficult. But the goal is to ensure that all long-term environmental and public health issues have been addressed. Because you can actually address the public health issues, but have property damage or have environmental issues that still need to be addressed. And lastly, the recovery phase. That's taking out the carpet, replacing a lot of maybe electrical or facility items that need to be fixed, maybe repainting. But throughout this entire stage, you know, all these stages, you're constantly asking a question that you're going to see comes up, have all the stakeholder needs been met? And that's a public policy issue. And that's really key to addressing this whole risk-informed response decision approach.
Question regarding response capability.
Sure.
So you mentioned that Los Alamos has been involved in this tularemia event. If somebody really wanted to overwhelm that system, how many sites would they need to attack simultaneously?
To overwhelm the whole BioWatch network system?
So it sounds like, I mean, people from Los Alamos going to the East Coast to deal with this potential event. So that concerns me with what capacity do we have to deal with multiple event sites?
Okay, well, maybe I should clarify my comment before. The BioWatch system is actually run by EPA. And all Los Alamos was sent to do, they are one of the emergency response teams that goes out to collect additional environmental samples. But the laboratories are a network all across the U.S. And actually, Lawrence Livermore was involved in analyzing those samples as well. And we were on standby as well if they needed to have more environmental sampling teams out there. So the system was by no means overwhelmed.
Do you feel there is considerable parallelism?
Yes, if I understand your concern. I don't think...
If somebody goes after 20 U.S. airports, we have enough people to deal with it.
20 U.S. airports? No, I wouldn't say comfortably we have enough people to deal with that. But you asked if I thought your question was aimed specifically at the BioWatch sensors set up in the cities and outdoor locations. And I think we have enough laboratories on standby and enough sampling teams to address those issues quickly. Now, communication is a different issue that, you know, between agencies, and getting communications to work better is that's an ongoing issue, and it was an issue in that incident as well. But no, 20 airports, I think we would be hard-pressed to respond to. However, that said, the hazmat teams are your first response, and I think they're trained to do a lot of the initial work that needs to be done. But if remediation were required at 20 airports, you saw what was required just at these, you know, postal facilities and how long that took. So it would wreak huge economic damage on the U.S.
I was considering response.
But I have another question on that same slide.
Well, on this one that's still up here?
Yep. The notification phase and the first response phase, how long did that last in the tularemia incident?
Well, we never got...
Because the hazmat people were there, no?
No, because Hazmat would only be deployed if you saw a real-time incident where you required some immediate emergency actions.
Okay.
Which you would if a suspect powder was released at an airport or a suspect powder was released in the subway in the case of a biological event. In the case of a chemical event, you would see immediate effects on people and there would be a call and hazmat teams would be there immediately also. In the case of the BioWatch sensor system, there is constantly being samples taken and analyzed every single day on a 24-hour turnaround in many major cities all across the U.S. So if when we are analyzing those samples, we see a signature match, we go back and we need to confirm it, unless it's so clear that it's obviously, you know, an agent of concern. And so that's done in this first response phase, but it's not part of the hazmat. It's a separate phase where we're doing environmental screening and constantly asking the question, is there an agent that's there that's not supposed to be? So a sensor, you get a hit on the sensor, and you make some notifications. So when there's a hit on the sensor, as there was in this case, CDC was notified right away. And they said, well, does it absolutely match for what we believe is tularemia? And the answer was no. It wasn't 100% positive match. So they said, well, do additional PCR on that, look at PCR extracts, try to fingerprint the DNA better, and at the same time, go out and collect samples around those sensors that had a positive hit and see if there's anything in the environment that's of concern. So all those things happened right away, and the analyses were done and turned around in a relatively short period of time.
So this is less than, say, 4 hours?
No, the PCR analysis itself, no, the sensors are sampled now on a 24-hour basis. Right now, they're sampled on a 24-hour basis. So the filters are taken, and it takes 6 to 8 hours to do the PCR analysis right now. Now, if you get a positive hit, CDC then would like you to culture it, because you could get a positive hit, but something could not be viable, and if it's not viable in the environment, no one's going to get infected, if it's especially in the case of naturally occurring things. For example, in California, I'll show you a view graph on this in a little while. I mean, if you live up in Brentwood, there's naturally occurring anthrax in the soil. It's there, and it's no individuals are getting sick because it's not weaponized grade anthrax, but it's there and it's naturally occurring. And it would set off one of these sensors had we put one in Brentwood, California, but we didn't do that. So, can I move on?
Yeah, I think we need to.
Okay. So, I just wanted to show you this chart. If there was an incident where chemical warfare agents were released in the environment, you can see from this chart, this is time and days across the bottom, and this is just counts from a GC mass spec, that for Livermore soil and Oakley soil, which is around in our area, that within about 3 days, you're below detection limits, with the exception of agent like mustard that goes on, you know, plasticizers or plastics. So if you had an outdoor event, I point this out because public policy needs to consider that the best approach might be to do nothing. The same is true potentially for biological warfare agents, but there's not as much literature. There's some, but it's mostly been focused on Bacillus anthracis spores in outdoor ambient settings. We know that 90% of the spores die within 50 years, but the remaining spores have the ability to grow and germinate. And spores can remain viable for 300 years. And that's a very old reference. And people have tested that, and we know that in the UK, in a desk, in a jar, are spores that have been there for 90 years. And they're still alive. Also, whether something lives in the environment for anthracis, again, is dependent on the pH and the calcium. There's a really good dependency there. So it's important to understand, and new research needs to be done, what are the conditions that sustain viability or stop viability? Because if you had an anthracis incident, and you wanted to look at humidity, you wanted to look at temperature, maybe it's in a building, you can jack up the temperature in the building and cause any kind of biological warfare agent to basically degrade in place, that's really a good approach. Spores are the most difficult biological warfare agent to decon. Other agents are much easier. Some of the agents are very hard to keep alive in the environment, even long enough to try to see if you can decon them. But anthrax, smallpox, and plague do stay out in the environment. So decontamination requirements for the civilian sector are actually very demanding. And what hazmat teams and cities would like is a single method effective against all chemical and biological agents. I mean, that's pretty simple. And it would be really nice if it were relatively non-corrosive, if it were non-hazardous as far as, you know, the breakdown products. Very short decontamination times would be nice. We need maximum contact on walls and ceilings. You know, you want to spray something and you want it to stick. You don't want it to just, you know, fall off. Inexpensive and available. This is the cities now asking us for their optimum material. A formulation that is stable with a long shelf life, greater than a year, and something that's easy to deploy. So it'd be nice if you could put it in a Gray Coast paint sprayer. It'd be nice if you could have a handheld bottle. I'm here to tell you that the current standard right now for surface decontamination is household bleach. That's the best material now. It's pretty cheap, but it is also very corrosive. It's 5% sodium hypochlorite. There's other things on the market that work perhaps as well, but they're all compared against sodium hypochlorite. The Army standard for DOD type of decontamination, military decontamination, is calcium hypochlorite. So that's the U.S. standard right now also. That's nice, but if you have, if you have a building that needs to be deconned, you really have to rely on a fumigant. You have to rely on a gas, because the Clorox, the household bleach, is not going to go into the ventilation system, into the nooks and crannies, and so you're really stuck with the two leading fumigants that have now been tested by the EPA because of the anthrax incidents, and those are vaporous hydrogen peroxide and chlorine dioxide. Now, vaporous hydrogen peroxide is much less corrosive. It's less destructive on electronic equipment. It has minimal waste materials associated with it, and it has just, in generally, a lower toxicity. Chlorine dioxide is, as you know, it's easier to generate in larger quantities, but it is very toxic in itself. But it does have a better track record. And I did have a picture there, but it seemed to have disappeared. But let me show you. This is the Brentwood fumigation operation, which used chlorine dioxide. And you can see how extensive it was. I mean, they had to basically build a chlorine dioxide distribution system in place. They had to bring in chlorine dioxide generators. They had to pump it into the building and make sure that they sealed it. They had to have transition zones. They had to set up spore strips to make sure that this process was working effectively. This is a major undertaking that had never been done before. And it wouldn't be any easier to do it now if we had to do it again. Yes, we could get the time scheduled down, but in looking at an operation like San Francisco Airport, we have a project where we're trying to say, okay, Brentwood took 2 years. How quickly could we decon San Francisco Airport if we had a similar incident? Our goal was to get down to 3 months, you know, if there was a way to do that. But we'll be lucky if it's 6 months right now, depending on how widespread an incident is within that building. 6 months of an airport like SFO losing, you know, $100 million a day is just, again, a real economic problem.
Is there any suspicion that whoever sent these letters knew the extensive cleanup effort required and was going less for damage to humans than for just disruption of congressional buildings?
That's a very good question. And I don't think they had any idea how difficult it would be to clean it up. And the reason I say that is I spoke just now about the postal facilities, but ABC was very easy to clean up. NBC was very easy to clean up. And there are reasons why those facilities were easier than the Postal Service. And I'll talk about those when I get to how clean is clean enough. But no, I don't think they realized it. I don't think we realized how difficult it would be to clean it up until we actually got in there and had to provide clearance of those buildings. And we realized that there was such a lack of understanding of infectious dose levels. So that said, you know, from what I just explained to you, you can see that there's major decontamination technology gaps as far as being able to speed up cleanup. And now, you're right, whoever asked that question, terrorists would know that this is a very, very difficult problem. I believe that more environmentally acceptable methods need to be developed. Some kind of more non-corrosive or non-toxic gases or aerosols that really attack the cell wall structure in a different way, not just oxidize the heck out of it, which is what these other materials do. It would be really good if we could develop or modify some kinds of technologies which would allow us to use more conventional gases and maybe neutralize some of the more toxic gases like paraformaldehyde in place. You know, when you call these pesticide companies to come and get rid of mold or fungus in your house, typically they use ethylene oxide or paraformaldehyde. And that's very effective. And what's nice about that is it's not as corrosive. I mean, it's just as toxic, but it's not as corrosive as, say, chlorine dioxide. So it doesn't tend to cause the facility damage. But we don't have a way to really introduce those things on a large scale, and we don't have a way to neutralize them. The only way to get rid of paraformaldehyde is dilution is the solution. And the EPA doesn't like the idea of just letting this leave the building, you know, a little bit at a time. Also, some specialized reactive materials would be
nice. So if I use this stuff to get mold out of my house, how do I then detox my house of this stuff?
Well, the company that does it actually sucks it out of your house. That's why it works fine on a small scale.
Okay.
And they can detoxify something like ethylene oxide on a small scale. But on a really large scale, like an airport, there just isn't a good way to do it now. So not to say that it's not technically feasible. We just don't have a technology that exists to do it right now.
Other than the lost productivity, how much does it cost to actually go and do decontamination of something that's that big, like SFO or a postal facility?
Well, the postal facility, like I said, costs $200 million for both of them. And that wasn't the time lost. That was just the cost of the contractors to do the decon and the EPA there and CDC to do the sampling and verification that it was clean. There are no good methods for deconning sensitive electronics. So if a terrorist were to attack something like the New York Stock Exchange, it could be difficult to recover a lot of that information if it's not backed up correctly. It would be good to evaluate radiation sources for DPW protection and decon. For example, we know that UV is very good for biological warfare agents and for neutralizing them. It might be possible in the future to have in subway systems UV curtains that can turn on and would allow, you know, would not allow any kind of agent to go from one part of the facility to the other. So there's a lot of things that we need to look at in the area of preparedness. And DHS has, over the last 2 years, scheduled a lot of preparedness workshops. We had one here in San Ramon for all of the West Coast airports. We had Seattle, we had LAX, we had San Francisco. We're planning to do that also on the East Coast and also for subways. One of the key things that we can't yet do, and this was evident in the tularemia incident in Washington, D.C., is we have no good ways to quickly determine whether an agent is viable or not. That's whether it's alive or dead. That's whether it can infect you or not. The only methods right now are to culture it. And culturing, depending on the agent, can take from 2 to 4 days. So it's difficult to tell if there's a hazard. And when you decon and you go in and you want to see if your decon's been effective, PCR, you hear all of this about PCR analysis, that just tells you that it's there. It doesn't tell you whether it's alive or it's dead. So even though that's a good technology for initial screening of whether you have something, we still rely on this. There are some methods that are being developed, but nothing exists right now. So, cleanup and decontamination decisions must address stakeholder concerns. I mentioned that before. What the stakeholders care about, and the stakeholders are the people, they're the cities, they're the EPA, they're the CDC, they can be anybody that has, you know, some stake in the decisions, the likelihood of the effect on the exposed population as a consequence of the event. So what is the relevant exposure? And this is true for RAD as well, as Chris mentioned. You know, is it inhalation? Is it dermal? Is it secondary ingestion? What's the route? And what is the potential mobility, fate, and transport of any residual contaminants, you know, or as far as just infection across the population itself? You know, what is the damage to the land, property, equipment? What's the cost of decontamination options with the time that's required? What are potential secondary contamination issues? If you go and you do decon, do you cause more toxic materials to be generated in place? You need to answer those questions. In some cases, it might be better to go in, dig up the contamination, cart it away to an adequate disposal site or an adequate treatment facility. The public confidence in decontamination methods, including sampling and verification, is key. I can do a lousy job of sampling and show I have a great decontamination process. And so you really have to balance those two. There's other relevant site-specific factors. You know, what are you going to use this site for? Is it a school nearby? Also, you want to worry about potential overreaction, because many times overreaction tends to drive something that is not an effective approach to cleanup. And so one thing that we've learned and that's come out of the studies we've done is that effective risk communication strategies are going to play an effective role, and they really need to be developed further. So how clean is clean enough, and how clean is safe? That's like the key question that the population in general is asking. That's the key question that regulators are asking. Now, for CW, there is a lot of information that's available, but for BW, it's very, very slim. There's two references that you can go to that we've published in the Journal of Environmental Health, and that talks about the infectious dose levels for all the biological agents and how they contradict each other. The newer article that just came out, this is the newer one, in 2004, lists all of the CW regulatory cleanup requirements. There's residential levels, there's industrial levels, there's general population levels, so there's been a lot more that's been done. But with regard to BW, since what we found is that it's inconclusive or inconsistent, about 2 years ago, we started a National Academy of Science study that just came out, I guess about 3 or 4 months ago, which is aimed at evaluating plague, smallpox, and bacillus anthracis, and what is required, what do we know as far as reopening public facilities. And so I just wanted to tell you about that study. It included 4 major elements, and you can go to the NAS study site online, and you can look at that reference, and you'll be able to find that report. It has a lot of public policy issues, a lot of technology gaps that have been identified. We reevaluated the infectious dose for the key bioagents and found that they were as bad as we believed. We tried to determine, based on existing information, the expert team, whether or not better infectious dose levels could be established, whether there was a better way to look at quantitative risk assessments and human health data. And what the committee found was that you can't really do it. It's so incident specific, because in the case of, say, anthrax, the weaponized grade, the way, the characteristics of the specific spore are what lend itself to the infectious dose. And so you really almost have to look at this case by case. So their recommendation was, yes, there's more experimental data that needs to be collected, but additionally, we need to come up with a better quantitative risk assessment model for BW specifically that's different from what we use for CAM and for radiation. And so that's a significant conclusion. Also, they looked at the doses available from natural and residual contamination levels, and they did review the past cleanup efforts to understand how things might be able to be done a little bit better, but I think I've touched on most of that. What they found is that smallpox can stay in the environment for a relatively long period of time, depending on how it's prepared. We had thought that it would be gone within, you know, a matter of days, but it can survive for weeks and maybe even for months. This map of California shows you all of the areas that are dark are all of the areas where anthrax is in very, very high levels, naturally occurring in California. And this is pretty indicative of a lot of places in the world, Australia, Africa. And so there is a level, and this is high. This is much higher than the 10,000 spores that I said, but no one is getting sick, and that really relates back to the grade of the spore and the type of the spore. So what level of cleanup will be required to meet both the regulatory and stakeholder needs? You really need to look at the potential for both acute and long-term chronic impacts on the key populations. The long-term dose toxicity data for CW is really not adequate, but the acute levels are enough that the EPA just last year, or maybe it was a year and a half ago, came out with some really good recommendations. But there's an ongoing study right now that we're doing at Los Angeles Airport where we're reevaluating what our recommendation would be to open up the airport again. And that information probably will be published in another 6 months. I can tell you that we're looking at the 8-hour eagles, for those of you that are familiar with that type of data. That looks like it would be effective. We don't want to be overly conservative or we're never going to open up these facilities. And the general population limits are below the analytical level of detection right now. So that makes it very difficult. Again, the infectious dose levels for many biological agents are incomplete or inconsistent, and we need to come up with better inhalation models and risk assessment data. Public acceptance does exist for biological risk efforts, and I point this out. It's actually very important. About 5 years ago, so I'm going to give you some examples. 5 years ago, a child died in a swimming pool in Atlanta, Georgia. Okay, she swallowed the water, and it was infected with E. coli. So one day later, 2 days later, that swimming pool was open again and everybody was swimming there. They didn't do anything except decontaminate it with sodium hypochlorite, our favorite decontamination material, Clorox or bleach, household bleach. They did culturing, okay, they did PCR, they don't see E. coli, but that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen the next day when somebody else, you know, doesn't use the restroom and decides to use the pool instead. The public's accepting. They don't want to tell their children not to go swimming. So there is a level of risk where inconvenience and economic drivers will really cause the population to accept more. NBC and ABC are another good example. Those buildings, even though they got letters, were open in a matter of days. Why? Well, NBC caused and ABC both called in hazmat teams, they came in with surface decon, they cleaned up the suites, and what happened? They said, we're ready for business. If you want to work here, you come to work. We're ready for business. And everybody went to work, and nobody got sick. That wasn't the case if you look at, you know, facilities owned by the U.S. government. Okay. Then the EPA was called in because the government is the owner of that facility, and when the government owns the facility, they turn to EPA as the federally funded agency to take control. In ABC's and NBC's case, they foot the bill, so they paid for the hazmat team to come in. And if you don't declare a federal emergency under FEMA, you as the operator own the bill. So, for example, if the Washington Metro, the D.C. Metro, were contaminated tomorrow and they called in the EPA or they called in a hazmat group, they would pay EPA. They would have to pay EPA. They need to get the facility declared under FEMA as a, you know, a general emergency, and then the government pays for the bill. Now, the facility down in Florida,
that one... We see how easy that is, right?
Excuse me?
So we see how easy that is.
Right. The facility in Florida that remained closed forever? Now let's look at that. Why did that remain closed forever? That happened because a tabloid was renting that building. So they moved out. Now, would you rent that building? No. And was there any incentive for the owner of that building to clean it up? There was. He wanted to burn it down and collect the, you know, the insurance. And he tried to do that, but the EPA came in and they did a risk assessment and they said, you can't burn it down because the spores in there represent a health hazard and there's no way to burn it down at a high enough temperature such that, you know, we can for sure ensure the safety of the public. So that became a test facility and it was eventually cleaned up and it's open now, but it was bought by a group for a dollar from the you know, facility owner. So it really does, you know, amount to public perception and stakeholder issues will drive cleanup requirements, but economic drivers and inconvenience will tend to influence stakeholders to accept higher risks. Whoops.
So why can't the government just hire an independent team? Why do they hire the EPA to come in and do it?
Well, that's a good question. But the main answer is that there was no, there were contractors used, and EPA hired two contractors to do the chlorine dioxide in the building, and they also hired another Steris Corporation to do the vaporous hydrogen peroxide. I mean, EPA doesn't have that material. But EPA is the coordinator for a federal response. Under the federal response plan, EPA has the responsibility for cleanup. And they also have it under CERCLA. So in both ways, they are the regulatory agency actually responsible for cleaning up.
So what you're saying is the same kinds of groups cleaned up NBC, ABC, and federal government buildings, but because the EPA is so inefficient.
No, I didn't say that.
I know you didn't say that. But.
Right, and I actually think the EPA was very efficient for the buildings that they cleaned up. What I said was that at a federal building or a building that's owned by the government, especially that's owned by, you know, our politicians, I mean, they wanted to be assured a certain level of cleanup. And nobody knew really how to do that, so the EPA had developed a whole process. Now, is EPA happy with NBC and ABC cleanup? No. They think that was the wrong approach. They think that, you know, there needed to be more clearance, more statistical sampling that was done before those individuals were allowed to go back in. But the agency that would have had to have halted anybody going back into buildings would have had to be the Public Health Service, and they relied on the hazmat teams. Now, when additional analysis was done on the spores from the letters, it's been since determined that the weaponized grade of the spores in NBC and ABC was such that it didn't transport as much. The inhalation factor was not as great, so the contamination risk was less, and so that's probably, in hindsight, we were very lucky that nobody got sick. The EPA actually has a very good process now for going in and doing clearance sampling. And we've been working with the EPA to try to shorten that for SFO, and there's a lot of lessons learned. They put out their own lessons learned document. They found it very hard to be able to contract quickly to these companies that had experience, but those were federal contracting, you know, issues. It was really nothing that the EPA did. And I'm done. So just in summary, which was my last few graphs, okay, there's still a lot of technology gaps, there's still a lot of room for public policy to be developed in this area, and so I encourage all of you as the new public policy people going out to really try to understand this issue, because it's something that we're all going to live with, and we want to protect our families as best as we can. So thank you.
Questions?